Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everyone. Our speaker tonight is Travis. Hi, Travis. Are you still in town or are you in Hawaii?
I'm in Mountain View.
Oh, you're in Mountain View. I thought you were already in Hawaii. Anyway, I think everyone here knows Travis, so I don't think we need any further introduction. Do you have a title to your talk?
Not really, but I'll be talking about the Diamond Sutra tonight.
The Diamond Sutra. Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, good evening. It's great. We've got a nice, small, intimate group here. I was talking with Carolina on Monday over coffee, and she at one point reminded me about several years ago when the students get together with Les sometimes and we talk about things. And in this particular time, maybe 5 years ago, he handed out the Diamond Sutra and we read it. And it's pretty central to Zen. The translation that we read was the one from D.T. Suzuki. From 1935. And I'd like to just start off by reading, it's a pretty short sutra, so I just like to read it from the top. I won't read the whole thing, but I'll read the first few paragraphs, which are numbered. Thus I have heard, at one time the Buddha stayed at Anathapa Pindaka's garden in the Grove of Jeddah in the kingdom of Shravasti. He was together with 1,250 great bhikkhus. When the mealtime came, the world-honored one put on his cloak and holding his bowl, entered the great city of Shravasti where he begged for food. Having finished his begging from door to door, he came back to his own place and took his meal. When this was done, he put away his cloak and bowl, washed his feet, spread his seat, and sat down. Then the venerable Subhuti, who was among the assembly, rose from his seat, bared his right shoulder, set his right knee on the ground, and respectfully folding his hands, addressed the Buddha thus. It is wonderful, world-honored one, that the Tathagata thinks so much of all of the bodhisattvas and instructs them so well. World-honored one, in case good men and good women ever raise the desire for supreme enlightenment, how would they abide in it? How would they keep their thoughts under control? The Buddha said, well said indeed, O Subhuti. As you say, the Tathagata thinks very much of all of the bodhisattvas and so instructs them well. But now listen attentively and I will tell you. In case good men and good women raise the desire for the supreme enlightenment, they should thus abide in it. They should thus keep their thoughts under control. So be it, world-honored one. I wish to listen to you. So that's the opening exchange. And it goes on like this. There's a section about conception. There's a section about acts of charity. I'd like to read you part six. Subhuti said to the Buddha, world honor one, if beings hear such words and statements, would they have true faith in them? The Buddha said to Subhuti, do not talk that way. Now, and I'm going to stop there. Because what I wanted to help give you a sense of is the nature of the interaction between the Buddha and his disciple Subhuti. They extend a case, and the case goes in different ways that we think about our lives and the world and our role in it. Things that we might start to think about as a philosophy. But about halfway through or so, Les said, you can see that the Buddha is not talking metaphysically. He's not, you know, building anything that's like metaphysics. And I said something like, well, metaphysics is just describing what it's like to be a human being. And that was kind of stopped the conversation. He didn't really reply to me. So in the years that have passed, and I've thought about this more and more, I think he was really, really teaching me, teaching the group something that's very valuable, even if my definition of metaphysics is correct. It's the overall system of thinking laid down in some of our core sutras, like the Diamond Sutra. It's really more no big metaphysics, no overarching metaphysics. Life is suffering is a metaphysical axiom. There's no physical element to it. It's stating something about reality that you can either accept or deny or augment, but it's a limited type of metaphysical system. And I think that's what Les was getting at. Along with no big or overarching metaphysical systems, I think our tradition is that we also not get attached to those types of systems of thought. So in the first case, just to kind of go back to it, how would they abide in enlightenment? How would they keep their thoughts under control? The practice helps us with that. Helps us not to be attached. Helps us with the role our intellect plays in our lives. Keeping balance there. And I'd say it also limits the ways in which we impose on others. So, you know, I always come back to the principle of like, we're starting off from a fundamental place where we're Buddhas, and I have to allow for your existence, my ethics, which you could have a whole ethics or moral philosophy like that could consume your life. But if I allow for you to be, that's a good start. And we can return to that even when we have difficulties. Also, I think one of the reasons I was so resistant to shutting down the metaphysical department at that time completely, at least that's how I perceived it, was we still in our day-to-day lives, we tend to talk about reality. Or we hear people talk about reality. And talking about reality is not reality. Already we're on our back foot there. So, you know, to say the Buddha didn't talk about metaphysics is probably more correct than tuning it up tuning up the sensitivity to anything you would say. So I'm really, you know, grateful for that teaching. And like many of the things Les has taught me, it's taken, you know, many years to sink in and mellow. You know, we live in a very conditioned existence, and the practice we've inherited, you know, this tradition is very pretty rare that we can even talk about this, but we get the chance to practice it together. And the pandemic has been very difficult. Society is metaphysical. All of society is metaphysical. So you can see the, I was thinking earlier about like when I was growing up, when I'd hear about a bug, there was like, this is when computers were starting to become popular. And it was like people, you'd think it was a computer bug, but a bug in a computer probably descended from viruses or bugs like in society and humanity. And, you know, we just experienced this pandemic where there was a bug and it destabilized all of society. And there's an opportunity there to see how unsubstantial it is and how arbitrary a lot of it is. But at the same time, as a practicing Buddhist, not to be attached, even with the big social issues. And we face, you know, several of them. And it's easy to be caught up. And to be caught up isn't necessarily even helpful for us. But we should work for a better world. But I think that teaching, when we talk about the practice, and when I've been fortunate enough to be able to hear the lessons that Les has taught, not to be attached to big ideas, which I continually find myself stuck in and then coming back. You know, I create systems at work all the time. So it's just after decades, it's natural that I would do that. So it's even more valuable that I have this ability to set that aside. And that's what the Diamond Sutra is teaching us, that the senses can be set aside and we can be in repose in Zazen. And that this is a sensible way to live. There's a great importance, I think, for this type of practice, because of the emphasis on logic and ethics and other types of systems of philosophy, and outsiders, you know, may term it a religion or a philosophy, but it's actually not that important for us. You know, I feel affection and love for Les, and I wanted to tell that story because he's not here. I think it's easier when he's not here. And just express my appreciation for his patience and, you know, the way that he's looked after this Sangha for so many years You know, there's, we meet difficulties despite that, you know, there can be hard feelings and neglect or feelings of betrayal that come up. And it just can take a conversation over coffee to unlock a little bit of that. So also grateful for having that coffee with Carolina on Monday. She said something about how we studied the Diamond Sutra, and I hadn't thought about that for some years. And that's like, oh yeah, well, I kind of remember saying this to Les, and I wouldn't say it quite that way today, but that's interesting. That's living in community. And that's Sangha when it works well, I think. And so grateful to her and grateful to Les, and happy you could all join me tonight. And just feeling a lot of affection for my teacher, and I hope he's doing well in Hawaii. And I won't be there for a few more weeks, but looking forward to that as well. Thank you. We have a pretty small group, so this could even be a little more conversational, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think I've met Anna. I thought it was our Anna Breckenridge, but hi, Anna. Welcome.
Hi, everyone. Sorry. This is my first time joining, actually, like anything at all.
Oh.
So that is why you do not recognize me. Yes. And sorry about the lighting. It's not the best lighting situation here.
It's okay. We can see you fine. Welcome.
Are you in the area of Mountain View?
Yes, I actually live in Sunnyvale. Uh-huh. And I think there's actually a Zen Buddhist temple in Sunnyvale. But I think the monks live there, actually. I think it's a residential temple. But I don't think that, I think I went there and I don't think that they have anything for like the public. And I think you can, you know, because of the pandemic. And then I found your temple, and then I showed up on Wednesday one day and realized it's okay. I took pictures and then I got the pamphlets and got all the information. I wrote my information down, so it worked out.
Okay. Well, welcome. As Travis said, we do sit every morning, weekday morning, and then there's coffee, which he also mentioned afterwards. So you're welcome to come to any of that, and on Saturday morning as well. So anyway, I really appreciate your talk, Travis, because you are brilliant and so educated in philosophy and history, and I've always been kind of awed at your talks in the past that have been so beautiful, but intellectual. And so I really appreciate your talk tonight, because you seem to have come full circle, and how wonderful that you have that intellect and that knowledge and that education. But then to be able to bring it to what's real, what's here, what's our practice, what's our realization, and getting out of your head. That's wonderful. It's so hard. It's really hard. We want to explain things. We want to understand things on an intellectual level, and that's not how our practice works. We want to hold on to something tangible. Mm-hmm. So thank you for reminding us of that. That's what I took from your talk.
Yeah, we want, and it's easy to get attached to the things that we love and wish that they could stay the way they are. And the gratitude I feel is just, it comes along with everything else, you know? So in the moments where I, you know, just accept that, that there's a purpose and a meaning, even if it's a thread that can't be really seen in our lives, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, I've thought about the nature of love a lot recently, I think in the past I've been kind of attached to a concept of unconditional love, you know, like I think that's an ideal, it's a grand ideal, and it's a noble aspiration, but it's not something that can be realized in an absolute, you know, but I'm fortunate that I've had people in my life that really taught me how to love. And because of that, I think less is teaching. I'm starting to feel the gratitude of that kind of love that he's taught me, and not tried to filter it through my intellect and that really opens up a lot of new possibilities, I think.
Yeah. Beautiful.
I liked Travis, what you were saying toward the end, too. That seems related to the topic of love. The way that we can have in conversation hurt feelings or even deep feelings of betrayal or whatever, and that the feeling that I got from listening to you talk about that. In the context, I think it was about that conversation where you challenged Les in some way that created a not a rift exactly, but just a ripple or whatever. And the notion that that there would be some kind of love, some kind of continuity in practice together, that years later you could come back and see that in a different way, just like Subhuti and the Buddha, maybe when he was reprimanded, that felt a little
yeah. Well, I think one of the things is Les has said, don't talk that way, or don't think like that. Now, I've definitely had him tell me that, and it's when I'm my most socially conscious or self-aware, or like bringing the projections of other people into what's a private conversation, and how do I look? How do I show up in the world? I can't fit in. and those kinds of questions, like, it's really a gift to have somebody literally say, don't think like that, and come back when you stop thinking like that. Because, you know, we can curry, we can spend our lives, and I think many people do, trying to find people when they're in a good mood, trying to find the conditions under which like someone is going to have a good time with me. And, you know, the great thing about Sangha is that we show up and we're there, and it's not always in the highs, and it's and you learn something from the lows, and that's something that you learn is that you can belong. You can belong however you come and however you show up. The belonging is not conditional. It's like these other things, wanting to convince, you know, some years ago, you know, we were talking about competing, and he said, don't compete. But since then, I've thought about the nature of competing and how it can also be in some milder form, just contention. And then in an even more like innocuous form, a kind of need to convince someone, maybe even in conversation. And it's not that we shouldn't make some kind of effort to share, but you can say what you think and leave some space. And that's what I'm trying to do, trying to be more aware of that part of myself, and not let it run away, and to listen deeply, and to take care of myself too. Because you create a certain personality that is just can be quite a character. I know in my case it is. Like, I'm dynamic. I'm trying to start a new team at work, and I'm trying to, you know, there's a certain like likability that has to happen, and a certain assuming that you're competent and confident, and those things might not be totally sustainable. They're not sustainable. And when we're young, we have our parents who take care of us, and they encourage us and to grow up and to to learn and to be generous and polite with our friends and with our neighbors. And that's a kind of conditional love. It's like, you know, you're great, but you should follow, you know, social norms and conventions. And I think, when we forget that, when we forget what it was like to be young, and how much effort that took, and that, because they have beginner's mind, right? The kids, there's an openness and a growth that's happening, and less of a self-awareness. But back to the self-care piece of it and the unsustainability of that. If you find yourself in your mid-40s still striving like that and doing more and more complex things, the thing that helps me is thinking about, you know, the opening scene in Mr. Rogers. You know the show, Mr. Rogers? Yeah. So he would go get back to his house, like he had just been out to the market or something. And then every time, as part of the intro, he would take his shoes off, his outside shoes, and he put the like inside loafers on, and then he'd take the sweater off and he put another sweater on that looked almost exactly the same. And it would be a whole thing. And he'd be singing like, "You're my neighbor. I love you. Thanks for being with me." And he was showing you not only like warmth and love, unconditional love of a neighborly kind, but he was also showing self-care. And and that's like, you know, those little cues that you pick up with somebody who's got that, and Les has got that.
He models in that way. Self-care, are you suggesting that with certain limits and a certain way of being, that he has a lot of love and caring, and also feel like he doesn't get lost.
He doesn't get lost, and or it he can find his way back relatively quickly. Not like me, I can go out for 5 or 10 minutes like I just did.
Thank you.
Thanks, Philip. You know, he gave a talk a few years ago about painting of a rice cake. I think he's done that talk a few times. You know, the one painting of a rice cake?
I know the story, yeah.
The story, yeah. And I think that sort of like, you know, the extra layer of, when I said, well, that's what it's like to be a human being. I think what it's like, what I said was like, that's how we would describe what it's like to be a human being, but that's not being a human being. Like we're already on like the back foot, as I said, because we're trying to capture this ephemeral thing with our intellects and with some sort of logical recourse, right? But that's not good. And he just looked at me and it was a hard look. I wish Carolina was here, because I'd say, yeah, I think that's why he like stopped those conversations. But I wish I hadn't really said it like that. You know, the thing about the Diamond Sutra is it's trying to knock out your logic, all the underpinnings of your intellect, and so it's pretty uncanny how it like takes away all the sort of logical, metaphysical, ethical, like all the major buckets that we might, you know, like say, but what about the world? Like what should we care about? Like, should we care about, like, let's say climate change? That would be like a modern thing. And I don't think that it's saying at all that we shouldn't worry about continued sustainable life on the earth and the well-being of, you know, our descendants and other life. And we have lots of other sutras that talk about that. And but at the same time, it's more for us, for our practice, how do we keep our thoughts under control? Because if we don't keep our thoughts under control, it's almost like you have to secure the oxygen in your face mask before you do anything else.
So when you described Mr. Rogers, I was thinking about the ritual of him taking off his shoes and changing his sweater and all of that. And then when you were talking about when we're children and we're taught by our parents how to behave, And then we have our precepts. Those are all guides and telling us how we should behave. But subtly, I think, through practice, those things seem to just come up as you intuitively know the right thing to do. So you might want to go out and do stuff about climate change. But in your own daily living, you intuitively know how you should use water, use resources, take care of things. And when it arises out of our practice and our reflection in practice, I think that's more genuine than trying to follow something outside of ourselves. And, you know, sometimes subtly things do come up and you intuitively just know through our practice. So anyway, that's your sense.
If I say that is a sense of groundedness, does that resonate with you, that word?
I mean, we could act compassionately and kindly to people, but when we do it from the heart and it's genuine, there's a difference. You know, you can act in a kindly manner, you can be polite, but to genuinely feel that connection with another human being and care about them and it to be real, that it's not always there, but I think it's something that can sometimes come out of our practice. I don't know. I'm not expressing it very articulately.
Well, if the Buddha wasn't that way, then how would you explain all of this?
Yeah. But yet they say even without the ancestors and the Buddhas, we have Buddha nature. It's the realization of our own Buddha nature. That's what we have to come to ultimately, you know.
Yeah, our own Buddha nature is ours, and I think it would be worse if someone tried to teach me something I wasn't ready to be taught. So it's better to wait and observe and maybe make a slight suggestion when the time's right.
The teacher appears.
And that just takes consistent contact. And, you know, another thing that Les is always, we've had a running conversation about is how do you get to a point where you know you have enough? And it's not so simple because it's always in our lives is, okay, well, maybe I'll head over here and see what's going on there. And we have interests and passions and, but to never feel like you have enough is, I think, a sickness that is particularly treatable. With that kind of quiet contemplation that I think you're talking about.
Yeah, true. We're human though, and we're always, those ideas and feelings are always going to come up, but the awareness of it, right? And just—
They're gonna come up and you gotta sometimes live with them. Like, I want this thing and I can't have it and it breaks my heart. I have regret. If only I had done this other thing like 3 months ago, I would have it now. And I am so regretful that I didn't do that. that I just have tears in my eyes about it. And you know, your sangha, your teacher, you know, they can help you understand that this is universal, and there's a way out of it. And the teaching of patience, the consistency of effort towards practice and settling, the groundedness you're talking about, the understanding of like, I have all these other things. How come I'm fixated on this? Whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And you can create a new world where you have enough. And you know, I feel like that, you know, that the way in which we move from like wanting things or comforts towards just wanting to be in a fundamental sense. Mm-hmm. That's metaphysical, but you know, it's so limited that, you know, you're never gonna run real far of that. And we say we trust in experience. So when we say that, we take, you know, the good and the bad experiences, and that's now with, you know, the pandemic, in particular, it's not only just that, like, I could see on a family or community level, like on a global level, we just did a big, you know, there was a big crest and trough. And then everyone's disrupted together. And Zoom, I wish we could be in person. Like, I think it's great to be able to be connected in Zoom, but maybe we will soon, you know, be able to have more in-person time. And and I think that's important for the whole person kind of, you know, experience. And we are more than thinking creatures, and we're more than like an image on a screen, you know.
Yeah.
And we're mammals, and we can hug each other, and we can see close into each other's eyes, and maybe it's easier than to like give somebody a little hint like I got from Les that morning, and like Carolina gave me on Monday.
Good. Well, so Anna is saying,
I hope to see us again. Yes, sorry, I didn't want to interrupt, but yes, I will be hopping off. I just wanted to quickly check, is this the Zoom link for all like meetings and meditations and all of that? Okay, all right, good, great, thanks. Yes. And, all right.
Thanks for joining, Anna.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, Travis. I had a question. You talked about getting your thoughts under control. What did you mean by that? I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, our thoughts are going to always be running, right?
Yeah.
It's not like you need to force all the thoughts out of your head. That would be that'd be a terrible proposition. Yeah. That's just not going to happen.
Right. Yeah.
There's a piece.
It doesn't have to happen.
And there can be a peace with the stream of consciousness that's coming through, just like the wind coming through the windows. And you know, it's just, it's more of that, aligning up your life in a way where you know what's enough and what's too much. And that's not even necessarily on a day-to-day, that's maybe more on a weekly or monthly basis. You're just, you know, hey, how's this going? Do I need to pick something up? Do I need to put it down?
Yeah.
Cause my mind could be overactive if I'm not physically active enough. Like
sure.
since the pandemic, like I've started bicycling a lot more. And I find that really helpful. And I kind of just do the same route out at the Palo Alto Bay lands. I'm not really worried about like where I'm going or, you know, there's no traffic, so I can just kind of get in a little bit of a zone.
Yeah.
But I have that physical activity and we need that because I was on my couch, like in Zoom calls for the last couple of years.
Yeah. And having enough, and maybe it's just age, but I'm starting to get where like I can want things, but I don't have to have them. You know, desires just come and go, and I don't have to have them. You know.
Yeah. What do you think about moods? Like, since you were younger, like when you're in a bad mood, like how's that relationship going?
Yeah, same thing. I'm not subject to my moods as much anymore. You know, when I was younger, man, my moods were reality. You know. they were the way the world was.
I'm trying to clear out some of that headroom because I, you know, my younger daughter's 14 and boy, she can have some big swings and just to be seeing it, receptive to it, like knowing I can't solve it, but I'm there. And
and it'll all smooth out. She'll get older than 14. And
I particularly now that our older one's out of the house, I feel a real call to be there for her because she's the only one and you know she had to be the younger sister, you know, for all those years and you know she went to her homecoming dance last weekend and she's out with her friends and it's just great to see.
Yeah. Well, she's lucky. She's lucky she's got you. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, her and her mom. We're grateful to have her. Yeah. Sure.
Anyway. Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Don. Great to see you.
Yeah, nice to see you too.
I was thinking about your Alan Watts, the time you had scheduled Alan Watts up at Kenyatta College, and you were telling me about that. And I found these KPFA archives of Alan Watts.
Yeah.
And just in the last week or two. And the one that I listened to is called Bus or Tram. It has a little limerick at the beginning. And he was talking about how, like, evangelicals, this is 1960, okay, so this is 60 years ago. Talking about evangelicals in this country have this belief in the afterlife where they're going to get even with the people that did them wrong, and like you're going to be so sorry for the things you did that he said that would be actually a probable cause of suicide. And I was like, wow, that's intense. And then I listened to Johnny Cash's album from 2002, and he has a song on there called Tear Stained Letter. And he has a funny song that's like entirely confirms Alan Watts's theory. And he wrote that 40 years later, but he was a contemporary, you know. He was a little younger, but he just played right into Alan Watts's theory there. But it was funny because it was like you could get to the third and fourth verse and you could tell that he still loves this other person.
Right.
And
he was
actually hoping that the relationship would come back together. But it was just a real like peeler. You know, that first verse was just like, oh man, that's a intense howler of a proposition that when you read this tear-stained letter, I just hope you won't go down to suicide because you're so sad about all the things you've done me wrong.
Yeah, Watts is brilliant, you know, but I spent a couple of days with him, and one thing he said, because I asked him about practice and all that, and he said, why should I spend any time sitting around a smelly old cold Zendo? He did not practice. He had nothing to do with that, man. But he was brilliant in interpreting things, you know?
Yeah.
Really, he had a great sense of humor. He was a sweet guy, really, really sweet guy, and absolutely brilliant, and had a great sense of humor. Yeah.
And I think for people who grew up with a certain kind of upbringing, or like a rigid kind of authoritarian upbringing, he gets into that like metaphysics of like ontology of like, what is it to be? And what is this actually really? What is all this?
Yeah.
You got all these brilliant, like, wait, this isn't actually like what's actually happening. Like existence is like this. It could be so fundamentally like simple.
Yeah.
That you're already there. And I think he's helped. I think he deserves a lot of credit for popularizing Zen.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It deserves to be said, even though he was an entertainer and he was popularizing things and to many. And now I've heard lots of his talks and, you know, there's a certain shtick or act that he's doing because you hear the same story like
told. He admitted to that. He even sometimes he would say, I'm just a charlatan, really.
I've just
got my act. I got this act called Alan Watts that I do. You know, he was aware of that and he copped to it, you know.
Or he'd say, like, if I meet you and I don't get a sense that there's like an inner rascal in you, some amount of rascality, like we can't be friends, like, or we can't do business together because like I don't understand you.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, it's just he came along at the right time, and his talks are still available. It's like he's almost like a precursor to social media, and he predicted a lot of things in like the internet and social media. So I think he was really a visionary in that sense.
Oh, yeah.
But for nothing else, then he helped a lot of people that have listened to him in the last 60 years, like kind of get unstuck from some things that are, I think we all know there are some things in the culture that are like pretty, pretty repressive. And like, there are people that can hear one of his talks and like change their, actually, that's the cool thing about love too. You can love someone you've never met. Yeah. And you can love someone based on like their art or their contributions to society, you know, because the effect on you could actually be that big. And I find that pretty remarkable.
Yeah. Despite, you know, I found that because I've met a few artists and some of them are just a bit of a disappointment, but it doesn't take away from what they did and the effect that their work has, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Pretty amazing, actually. The work is something that even transcends the artist, I think. You know, who they are personally, they might be some of them pretty unpleasant people, actually. Yeah. But their work was right on the money, you know?
Yeah. Well, they're in the more idealistic world, right? Because they have to, they're projecting something in like, maybe like a poetic way. I think Alan Watts says things that are poetic.
Oh.
And
he, when I was spending time with him, I was talking to him about things. He had this thing he used to say where, you know, like about the shape of the infinite. And at the time I was young, wait a minute, man, how can the infinite have a shape? You can't even get outside of it to give it the shape, you know?
Yeah.
He just turned when I asked him that question. He just pointed to things in the room and went, it has precisely that shape. In that shape, you know, it was just like ding, a little light went on. Oh, yeah, you know. So he was definitely had his uses and helped a lot of people. He helped me tremendously, you know, and got me involved in Zen, you know. Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah,
thanks for that story.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
Don, where did you know Alan Watts from?
Well, I was in college. And I had read all his books, or every book that he'd come out. I thought the guy was levitate, never touched the ground, and glowed. I mean, he was my idol because of all the, he made everything so clear. And I was in a psych department, and the head of the psych department said, well, let's get him here. Because I was talking about how wonderful this guy is and all the things he says. He says, let's get him here. I said, what do you mean, let's get him here? Let's get him here. Let's get him here. Turned out you could call him up on a phone. He lived in Sausalito, and he had a house on Mount Tam and a houseboat in Sausalito. And you could, at that time, you could hire him for the whole day.
Wow.
$750. You had a fee, and you had him. And he, like, come to your college, do whatever. You had him for the whole day. And the way we paid for it is we ended the day with him giving a lecture in the auditorium and charged everyone $2. And he filled it, of course, so we could pay him and everything. And so that's how I got acquainted with him. And then drove him home. I picked him up in Sausalito. And then we drove him home to his house in Montana Park. I said, well, you guys have to come by again. So I had spent a couple of days with him and getting to know him and all. And, you know, so, yeah, that's how that happened. I was just a student and they said, yeah, well, let's get him here. And I'm thinking, are you kidding? You can't do that. But yes, you can. Yeah, it was easy, actually.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
What an experience.
But he was a hell of a really nice guy. Really sweet guy. Very spontaneous, very authentic, you know, just boom, it was him. Tremendous sense of humor and absolutely brilliant. I mean, you know, he could talk about anything, I think, and make it all up on the spot, and it was brilliant. It was just brilliant. Yeah.
What an experience.
Yeah, it was, yeah, especially for me. I was so young. I was, you know, this was a long time ago. When I was in college, and man, yeah, it was great. And he wasn't a disappointment, but I met other famous people, and I was, wow, so surprised to find out that this guy is a racist and everything else, and all these writings are so cool, you know? So I learned to separate the artist from their work. And you probably have had this experience. A lot of times you may get engaged in a creative activity, and what comes out just comes out. It's not really something, you know, that I actually created, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
It just comes out of somewhere, you know?
It's true.
Yeah.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.